This talk is going to deal with why capitalism became neoliberal, and it's going to ask the question, is capitalism ceasing to be neoliberal? Because it seems as though states are back intervening in economies again with a vengeance. It seems as though there are certain things that can't just be left to the market to run. So on the 12th of December last year, the Federal Reserve, the central bank in the United States, introduced an auction facility to trade up to $20 billion of debt for subprime securities. In other words, the rotten securities that were based on loans such as ninja loans. Have you heard of ninja loans? Ninja loans are loans to people with no incomes and no jobs so that they can buy a house. Some of those loans have gone a bit pear-shaped in the United States. So this auction facility was introduced to the tune of $20 billion in order to try and neutralise some of these bad loans that are ramifying throughout not only the US financial system but the global financial system. On the 22nd of February this year, the UK government nationalised Northern Rock, which is not a geographical formation, but is essentially a big mortgage lender in the UK, one of the top five mortgage lenders in the UK, which was highly dependent on wholesale credit markets. In other words, it borrowed the money that it lent out to people who were buying homes on international credit markets. The problems in the United States have led to dramatic increases in interest rates on those wholesale global markets, and that created problems for Northern Rock, so the British government nationalised it. On the 11th of March, the Federal Reserve in the US introduced a term securities lending facility to trade up to $200 billion for certain mortgage-backed securities, again, in order to try and neutralise some of the consequences of the subprime crisis in the US. So we had a facility for $20 billion, which the Federal Reserve hoped would smooth things over in December last year, $200 billion worth of essentially bailout this month. Then on the 14th of March, the Federal Reserve backed a bailout of Bear Stearns, one of the largest merchant banks in Wall Street, one of the top five banks on Wall Street, which was about to go under. Significant funds from the Federal Reserve, and it was then taken over by one of the other big merchant banks. Emmanuel Wallerstein, who is a long-term socialist and a father of what's known as world systems theory, a theory of imperialism, which has some flaws, but nevertheless a theory of imperialism, he wrote the beginning of this year, an article called 2008, The Demise of Neoliberal Globalization. And in the article he wrote, so what are the policy conclusions that governments and populations are drawing from the pricking of the credit bubble? There seem to be four in the offing. The first is the end of the role of the US dollar as the reserve currency of the world, which renders impossible the continuance of the policy of super indebtedness of both the government of the United States and its consumers. The second is the return to a high degree of protectionism, both in the global north and the global south. The third is the return of state acquisition of failing enterprises and the implementation of Keynesian measures. The last is the return of more social welfare. So Wallerstein is arguing that the age of neoliberalism is over. He identifies a number of factors that were associated with neoliberalism, which he thinks are gone or are in the process of going. I want to address those arguments a little later on, but I want to start by saying, well, where did neoliberalism come from? What's it a product of? And that's pretty easy to answer. Neoliberalism was a response to the end of the long post-war boom of global capitalism, a boom that saw sustained high growth rates during the 1950s through the 1960s into the early 1970s. So that in this period, while there were little recessions, a recession technically speaking is two quarters of negative growth. Negative growth in the English language means when the economy actually shrinks. The recessions during this long boom period were generally very shallow indeed, and the recovery periods were pretty steep and impressive. That essentially came to an end in the early to mid 1970s, where you had coordinated recessions across all sorts of countries on the whole of the planet, and recessions that were each one subsequently the deepest one since the Great Depression. The one of around 1974-75, the deepest recession since the Great Depression of the early 1930s. The one that came in the early 1980s, again, on a global scale, the deepest since the Great Depression, and similarly with the one at the end of the 1980s and the beginning of the 1990s, a deep, deep recession. There were, of course, recovery periods in between, but it seemed that the pattern of the long boom had changed. And the immediate recourse that policymakers had was to open up John Maynard Keynes' General Theory of Employment, Interest and Money, which supposedly had been crucial in ending the Great Depression. Here was a bourgeois economist who had addressed or had recognised the problems of the Great Depression and had laid out the kinds of measures that would be necessary to overcome depression. Now, just in brackets here, it wasn't the clever mind of a Cambridge economist, Keynes himself, that ended the Great Depression in Britain, let alone anywhere else in the world. The Depression ended with World War II. At the end of the 1930s, the main economies, the largest, most powerful economies in the world, were turning down again. There'd been some recovery from the crash of the beginning of the 1930s, but the downturn in the US certainly from 1938 was sharper than the downturn in 1929. What changed that? The Second World War changed that. After the war, there was widespread anticipation that there would be another downturn, that there would be an immediate post-war recession the way there had been after the First World War, and then people thought that could lead to further problems back to the 1930s. But there was a degree of confidence among some policymakers, and by the late 1940s, policymakers in general had gone over to Keynes's ideas. In particular, the idea that government intervention, increased government expenditure, if the economy was turning down, could essentially boost things back up again, keep the economy on an even keel. And it seemed as though it worked, because we had this long period of pretty impressive growth. But actually, the kinds of measures that Keynes had talked about, the scale of government investment in infrastructure projects, which we hear a bit about in Australia today, in welfare and so on, the scale that Keynes had talked about was never needed in the post-war period. Keynes's policies were never really tested in the 50s and the 60s. His approach to economic management was transformed into fine-tuning rather than dealing with a deep economic downturn. And fine-tuning meant trying to make sure that the recessions were relatively shallow and that the recovery periods weren't too steep so that they would precipitate into another recession later on, rather than dealing with the economy as in a nosedive, what the fuck do we do? We turn to Keynes. It's only in the early 1970s that the real policies that Keynes had talked about began to be thought about, because we had the beginnings of global recession again, and deep recession comparable with that of the Great Depression. It wasn't as deep as the Great Depression, but it was a severe economic downturn, in part triggered, not caused by, but immediately triggered by dramatic increases in oil prices, because the Middle Eastern oil producers decided that they wanted a bit more of a return from their output, and that they should get more of a return rather than UK and US oil companies. Keynesian policies were tried. Pump priming, it was called. Prime up the pump, get the water out, and it will keep on flying all of its own accord. But what happens in the early 1970s or in the mid-1970s? Governments start spending more, and what they anticipate is that unemployment will decrease and the economy will start recovering and things will be all right. They also thought during the 1950s and 60s that there was a kind of trade-off between inflation and unemployment. If unemployment was high, large numbers of people were unemployed, there'd be less people trying to buy stuff, and prices wouldn't be bidded up, so inflation would be low. On the other hand, if unemployment was low, more people in employment, prices would be bidded up, and inflation could take off. But what happened in the mid-1970s? There was stagflation. You had high unemployment and high inflation at the same time. And the government expenditure to try and keep the economy on an even keel, to keep employment up, also boosted inflation. And the first occasion on which change in policies are really tried out in practice to deal with a severe economic downturn, what happens? Keynes is out. By the 1950s, throughout the economics profession, Keynesianism was a dominant approach to understanding economies and to how to manage them. There were some ratbags on the right who argued that Keynesian policies were too state-oriented and rather what you should just let the market rip, but they were total ratbags, utterly marginal. People like Milton Friedman was on the margins of the economics profession. There were also other people who, by and large, weren't very much in the economics profession at all. There were a few. There were Marxists who argued that actually underpinning the problems of the economy in the 1970s was something deeper than just supply and demand. It had to do with profit rates, and it had to do with the way in which the basis of the long boom had been eroded by its very success. At the beginning of the 1950s, the USA produced approaching half of the world's global output. Half of the world's global output. And that meant that what happened in the US economy was crucial for what happened in the global economy. Profit rates during the period of the long boom were gradually reduced, essentially because living labour was displaced by dead labour. In other words, there was more and more investment. The ratio of investment in machinery and equipment, plant, buildings and so on, compared to what was outlaid on wages, dramatically increased. Now, that didn't lead to higher unemployment because the economy was growing and the increase in the size of the workforce could be absorbed because the economies, the big economies, were growing rapidly enough. But eventually, the fact that more and more was being outlaid on machinery and equipment and so on, compared with wages, had an effect on profit rates. Because it's only the living labour, the labour that living human beings do, we call them workers, it's only their labour that actually creates new value. And to the extent that the ratio between the new value creating labour of workers decreases in comparison to the outlays on machinery and equipment, that is going to force down profit rates. That's what happened during the 50s and the 1960s. What's more, the United States engaged in huge spending on arms production, which helped stabilize profit rates for a considerable period of time. I won't go into why that was the case. You'll just have to take it for the moment, at least, that it did do that. That stabilized global profit rates because the US was producing such a large proportion of global output. However, there were major competitors emerging to the United States in Europe, particularly Germany, but other countries in Europe, and in Japan, that didn't have the burden of arms expenditure. They could spend a much bigger proportion of the profits that had been made back into making labour in their countries more productive. In other words, spending more on machinery and equipment that actually increases the output of labour. So the late 1960s and the early 1970s, profit rates were reduced, and what's more, the weight of the US in the global economy had decreased dramatically, partly because the US was stabilising global profit rates and other countries, other developed capitalist countries, were able to take advantage of that. Today, the US produces somewhat less than a quarter of global output compared to roughly half of global output at the beginning of the long boom. So underpinning the crisis of the mid-1970s was falling profit rates. Keynesian policies weren't working. Where do we look next? And where economists from a series of different countries, policymakers, politicians looked was to ratbags. Not ratbags on the left, like us, surprise, surprise, but ratbags on the right, on the margins of the economics profession, like Milton Friedman, who believed in a kind of a voodoo that the size of the money supply, both the amount of money that was printed by banks and also the credit that banks issued on the basis of their deposits, that was crucial in maintaining economic stability, both in terms of employment and in terms of inflation. So the first recourse after Keynesian economics was monetarist economics. Now, there was a guy who was the treasurer in Australia who was the first who introduced the first monetarist budget in Australia. Some of you may remember him wearing a top hat and looking like a total prat when he was the Governor General. At that time, he was a Labor treasurer and he introduced the first monetarist budget in Australia in 1975, a conservative budget that adhered to these ideas about controlling the money supply, and along with them, Friedman's ideas about letting the market rip and reducing the scale of government outlays, a key aspect of monetarism along with control of the money supply. So the first monetarist budget is brought down by a Labor treasurer. Now, the Australian economy recovered, global economies recovered after the downturn of the mid-1970s, but there's another problem in the late 1970s and the early 1980s, another economic downturn, and essentially economists and policymakers go off monetarism. And what they embrace in the United States is known as Reaganomics, after President Reagan. It's sometimes called supply-side economics. In New Zealand, it was called Rogernomics because the treasurer there, a Labor treasurer, was Roger Douglas. In the USSR, it was called perestroika. Australia had its own name for this. It was economic rationalism. But on a global scale, it came under the label neoliberalism. And neoliberalism as an ideology emphasised that the market works. That if you just let the market operate, if you reduce the scale of state activities, state interventions into the market, which distorts markets, especially protectionism, taxes on imports, quotas on imports, if you overcome state intervention in labour markets by doing things like recognising trade unions, which obviously stuff up labour markets, if you do these things, then the economy will more or less look after itself. We just have to withdraw the state, control state expenditure, keep state expenditure down, and markets will solve problems. These policies were embraced by governments in developed countries around the world, including Australia, and also by the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and when it's eventually formed in the 1990s, the World Trade Organization. In Australia, the first government that really takes economic rationalism, neoliberalism, seriously in all but one respect, really, is again a Labor government. It's the Labor government of Bob Hawke, which frees up, or says that it's freeing up, a series of markets. It frees up financial markets by reducing restrictions on the number of banks that can operate in Australia, the kinds of controls that the Reserve Bank of Australia, which is the central bank, imposes on banking institutions. It dramatically reduced the level of protectionism for the Australian economy by cutting tariffs, that's taxes on imports, and quotas on imports, that is quantitative limits on the number of cars, for example, that can come into the economy. The one area where the Labor government didn't deregulate in quite that way was in the labour market, where it in fact had a deal with the trade union movement that was the core of its overall policies. The deal was called the Prices and Incomes Accord, and unlike Margaret Thatcher in the UK, who did not succeed in cutting real wages during the economic recovery of the 1980s, the Hawke government in Australia succeeded, for the first time in Australian history, in cutting real wages, that is wages after inflation, during a recovery period, thanks to the accord. In practice, neoliberalism operates in a number of areas. In relation to government-operated enterprises, neoliberalism means privatisation. In Australia, once upon a time, the main organisation that provided telecommunication services, which was originally set up as the Postmaster General's Department, that was divided up and it became Telecom. That was owned by the government, believe it or not. That got sold off and the selling off started under Labor. There are a whole series of other state enterprises that were sold off. There's also been marketisation of some kinds of state activities. Electricity provision in New South Wales, for example, before the current talk of privatising it, selling off electricity generation in New South Wales, there has been marketisation of electricity generation and electricity retailing in New South Wales, so that all of the electricity system is actually state-owned, but it's been divided up into separate corporations which have been pushed into competing with each other. And corporatisation, that is running state-owned enterprises as though they were business enterprises, in fact constituting them under business legislation as corporations, is another aspect of neoliberalism. Deregulation of various kinds of markets, in Australia especially financial markets, banking and so on, has also been a key aspect of neoliberalism. Actually, to call this deregulation is somewhat misleading, because it's not as though governments have said at any stage, oh, well, look, you do what you bloody like, banks. We don't care. We're not going to do anything. We don't care what happens with interest rates. We don't care what happens with exchange rates. That is what the Australian dollar exchanges for against other currencies. You just deal with that yourselves in the banking sector and private individuals. No, deregulation was, in fact, a different form of regulation. It was a re-regulation. But it was a re-regulation that gave somewhat greater autonomy to financial institutions when it came to deregulation of the financial sector. Reduction in protectionist policies, tariff cuts and eliminating quotas are also characteristic neoliberal policies, just letting the market decide how much should be imported and exported and the prices, rather than governments trying to regulate those sorts of things. Reducing subsidies on certain necessities of life are also a characteristic neoliberal policy. That has applied in Australia to some extent in electricity provision of water services, where essentially there was some level of subsidy some of the time, gone with the process of marketisation. But nevertheless, before that, there was a degree of subsidisation. Much more obvious in a series of less developed countries where there have been subsidies on food, on cooking oil, and on fuel, essentially to prop up the living standards of the various very poorest sectors of the workforce. There's also been the freeing up of labour markets by removing obstacles to individual decisions by individual workers and their individual employers, because as we all know, you and I have just as much power in the market as, you know, a manager who's running BHP Billiton and hiring people. And so we can talk to each other. Of course, you know, we're going to have a chat with the CEO of BHP Billiton when we're looking for a job there. So it's only fair that you deregulate labour markets. In other words, you eliminate the privileged position of trade unions. And that was essentially what the Work Choices legislation was doing. It should be highlighted, though, that the Work Choices legislation was not the first act of this deregulation of labour markets, and nor was the Howard government's earlier policies to do with trade unions and industrial relations. In fact, some of these changes also go back to the Hawke-Keating era and a deregulation of labour markets. Final area that's characteristic of neoliberal policy is market-oriented welfare reform, which is all about helping the less able people to get a job. And essentially you do that by giving them incentives to get a job, which means you cut their benefits. Now, this series of policies, in a sense, have a real logic behind them. They can work. They are ideology in some respects, but on the other hand, they can work for the capitalist class. The way they work is not the way they are said to work. That is, that neoliberalism is ideology that says that the free market will make life better for everybody. Does anybody who doubts that it works that way? It doesn't work that way. On the other hand, neoliberal policies, the kind of policies that I've talked about, do serve the national interest. And we know who defines the national interest, the people who have power in the nation, the people who own or control the productive resources of the country, whether by virtue of being at the top of corporations or at the top of various state institutions. They're the ones who define the national interest, and they're the ones who can benefit from aspects of neoliberal policy and have benefited from those policies. In other words, the ruling class can benefit from neoliberalism. As an ideology, neoliberalism can work for the capitalist class to the extent that people believe it, that they accept the inevitability of cuts in jobs or wages or worse conditions or higher charges for public services, paying for their university education and so on. If they believe that instead of fighting, well, that can actually work in the capitalist class's interest. If people don't fight, then the kinds of cuts that neoliberalism leads to can actually work. Because the secret of neoliberalism is that it's all about boosting profits. Different ways of boosting profits, but it's all about boosting profits. Neoliberalism can work by depoliticising cuts in state enterprises or increases in charges by state enterprises. And that's clearly what's happened with the privatisation of electricity in Victoria, of water reticulation in South Australia, and it's what the progressive socialist Yemma government has in mind in New South Wales when it wants to sell off, and still looks like it may well sell off, the power industry in New South Wales. Because once those enterprises are sold off, government and charges for water rates, charges for electricity, for gas and so on increase, governments can say, nothing to do with us, it's just the market. Nothing to do with us, it's a depoliticisation. Privatisations and corporatisations and marketisations are all an opportunity to attack wages and conditions. They're all excuses to attack wages and conditions. You sell off an enterprise, the new owners slash the level of the size of the workforce, they try and push down wages, or in anticipation of getting a better price for selling off public enterprises, the state managers cut the number of jobs and hold down wages. These things can work as well. They can help to increase profit rates. privatisations and reductions in protection imposed on poor countries by the IMF and World Bank and other lenders to poor countries benefit transnational corporations, which gain assets and markets by virtue of less state ownership and less protection for domestic industry. The same things can also mean more funds are available to pay back debts. Sorry, not the same things. Cutbacks in subsidies and state services imposed on poorer countries can mean that more funds are available to pay back debt to lenders. What works, in other words, are measures that increase the exploitation of the working class either directly by cutting their immediate wages and their conditions, undermining their ability to defend themselves through their trade unions, or indirectly by reducing state spending or subsidies that benefit workers. What doesn't work is the idea that the private sector is inherently more efficient than the public sector. There's no real evidence to indicate that that's the case at all. And there are contradictions in the process of privatising large bits of the public sector and making a lot of money for governments in the privatisation process and the commitment to markets. Because if you privatise a monopoly, you're going to get a lot better return. Other corporations, insurance companies, superannuation funds are going to pay a lot more to buy a monopoly than they are little bits and pieces of a carved up monopoly. So what was privatised in Australian telecommunications was the whole of Telstra. It wasn't divided up so there would be competition, and Telstra is still, to a significant extent, a monopoly. Another problem with the process of neoliberalism is that opening up markets has, if anything, made economies more vulnerable to international spread of recessions and crises. There has been an increase in the integration of the global economy, not that the global economy is a product of the process of globalisation that only began in around 1990 or something. The process of globalisation really, if you look at it, goes back to the Neolithic period and accelerated dramatically under capitalism and was pretty rapid in the post-war period. But reduction in protectionism, tariffs and so on has increased the integration of the global economy, and therefore it's meant that the Australian economy is even more vulnerable, and the Australian economy is a pretty one that's pretty integrated in the global economy, is even more vulnerable to problems amongst its major trading partners. Neoliberalism has not been something that has simply been implemented from above with those who it's been imposed upon just accepting it. Neoliberalism is the capitalist class pursuing its interests against workers and members of other subordinate classes, and though the working class and other subordinate classes have not simply sat back and taken it. The Indonesian Revolution of 1998 that brought down the Suharto government was triggered by neoliberal policies and a recession. The Bolivian Coalition Defence of Water and Life that successfully turned back the 1997 water privatisation in Cochabamba province in April 2000, prefigured the movement against gas privatisations that brought down the government in 2003 and led to a dramatic radicalisation in Bolivian politics. The Argentinian uprising of 2001 that saw three governments fall in 1 year was again precipitated by struggles against neoliberalism in the course of a very sharp recession. And we saw the mobilisations against work choices over the past 2.5 years. Now, Emmanuel Wallerstein, to get back to where I started, argues that neoliberalism looks like being finished. And I'll go through the reasons why he says this. He says that the US dollar as a reserve currency is coming to a close. The fact that the global medium of exchange has been the US dollar, and this has allowed the United States to run balance of trade deficits for a prolonged period of time, because other countries just accept the dollars because they can use them not only to buy stuff from the US, but to buy stuff from other countries as well. Well, that hasn't gone. It may go eventually, and there are signs that faith in the US dollar is decreasing, so that the pumping back of money into the United States by those who are creditors to the United States looks like it's slowing down. In the Middle East, the oil producing countries have just pumped back the money that they have earned by selling oil to the United States back to the United States by virtue of investing in the US economy and US Treasury bonds and so on. And there's some sign that that's diminishing, but it certainly hasn't gone. Wallerstein argued that there's been a return of protectionism, but the evidence of that, I think, is very slender indeed. He's argued that there's been a return of state ownership and Keynesianism. Well, given the examples I talked about at the beginning of the nationalisation of Northern Rock in the UK, the bailout of Bear Stearns, the Federal Reserve's policies in pushing down interest rates and buying back dud securities based on subprime mortgages, you might say, well, that sounds pretty plausible. In addition to President Bush's government handing back a tax return to ordinary people last year to try and get the economy going again to get people spending more. But in fact, state ownership and Keynesianism and state intervention never went away. There's actually been an increased state share of gross domestic product an increased state share of gross domestic product in the United States and Australia, including under the Howard government. Now, I've got a little chart that shows this here, but you probably won't be able to see it at the back. You can come down and look at the front later. If the sun shone out of my ass the way that it does out of Kevin Rudd's, I could project this onto the roof. But unfortunately, it doesn't. But what it shows is that the government share of government tax revenue as a percentage of GDP has trended upwards in the whole period since 1965. So that the idea that the state has actually shrunk in its weight in the economy is actually a myth. It's a myth for the whole of the neoliberal period. What's more, there have been bailouts of a series of major companies well before the Bear Stearns stuff. Chrysler was bailed out in 1979. The long-term capital management hedge fund was bailed out in 1998. Chris Harman, in an excellent article on neoliberalism last year, wrote that the US has financed government spending by the, quote, Keynesian method of borrowing through most of the neoliberal period in a way that it did not do in the Keynesian era. So the idea that increased government intervention of particular kinds is dramatically new is not actually the case. There are no signs that I can see at all that there's a return to more social welfare redistributive policies. On the contrary, except in some countries where there are populist governments, particularly those who happen to be lucky enough to sit on top of oil fields, except there, and that's very rare, the trend is in the opposite direction, redistribution from the bottom to the top. Now, when Keynesianism came up against the crisis of the mid-1970s, it did not succeed and was abandoned as an ideology. It was an ideology in that it said, governments can solve economic crises. Don't worry, we've got everything under control. It flopped. That did not mean that all the measures advocated by Keynesianism were dropped. Most notably, powerful governments intervening in markets and changing rules to benefit locally based capitals, that has continued. That was a feature of the Keynesian period, and what's more, we might say it existed before that, and it's continued into the neoliberal period as well. In other words, states still act in the interests of capital. When neoliberalism came up against various problems with markets, its main ideological commandments have been ignored, that is, leave it to the market. That's especially obvious today, and it will weaken the credibility of neoliberalism as an ideology that some people buy. You've got to cop it because you've just got to let the market rip. Given the intervention in controlling markets, trying to go against markets by the neoliberal US government, the neoliberal government in the UK, that argument carries much less weight today. But these developments do not mean that all neoliberal policies that benefit capital will be dropped. In particular, those that squeeze more surplus value out of the working class, like holding down wages, restricting the size of the welfare state, and attacking unions, these things are likely to continue. They are continuing in Australia. The end of neoliberalism depends on resistance that takes on the symptoms of capitalist crisis in capitalist policy. That is, capitalist neoliberal policy has to be resisted if neoliberalism is to be resisted. But what does neoliberal policy rest on? Neoliberal policies that are going to continue, whatever Emmanuel Wallerstein hopes. They rest on capitalism and the need of capitalism for profits and the pressure on those profits from the very process of reinvestment itself. In other words, resistance to neoliberalism will continue, and for that to be successful, it has to smash the source of neoliberalism, which is capitalism itself.